Well, if you're like me, you take a little of your pet wherever you go. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Starting the show today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk by talking about shedding on the show. So, Dr. Sandy, of course, clinical instructor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Shedding can be annoying, but it can also be a symptom of something more serious. So we'll take a look at what's normal shedding, what's not, and ways you can control it. So what other pet care questions do you have as well? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It's nice to be here, Larry.
I am wearing my black
sweater. We wear black? I mean, look at me. I have a black turtleneck on, and I've only seen a couple of cases this morning before I came here, and I'm already covered in hair. Some of it may have been from my house as well, but it's just goes part and parcel with having pets, unfortunately. So,
you know, I have to be really careful where I set this down. Even sometimes I've set it on the back of a chair, and the cat manages to get up on the back of the chair and
leave hair behind. I have a little bit of trivia for you that I thought when I found this out, I was like, well, no wonder we have so much hair in our home. Dogs have approximately 15,000 hairs per square inch of skin. 15,000. Cats, they have four times that, 60,000 hairs per square inch.
Oh.
So knowing that, you've got, that's why we're dealing with a lot of hair. And, you know, hair doesn't always, every hair goes through this normal four-stage cycle, but they're not all doing it at the same time. So if they did, then we would have our pets all losing their hair and then getting their hair back. So it's always like this mosaic pattern of like hair falling out in one place over the other, but not all at the same time. And so our pets that are just normal shedders, you won't see bald spots or anything. It's just you're dealing with the hair on your furniture and everything else. Now, there are some seasonal variations that we see with hair. We know that in the spring and fall, because we've got change in temperature and the photo period, that can trigger more hair loss. It's like they go through a more rapid shedding of hair. But because most of our pets, like your cats and my cat, my dogs go in and out, so they're not quite as affected. They're indoors. They're not quite as affected by temperatures and the seasonality. So they just shed year-round. And
yes,
you know,
they do.
Yeah, and the only time I really get worried about it is if I see true thinning of the hair. Now, me having bulldogs, one of the problems that we see with them is this thing called seasonal flank alopecia, where they lose hair on their sides, and it tends to be associated in the darker winter months. They lose their hair, and then once the days start getting longer, they get their hair back. And that's a genetic trait that we see in certain breeds of dogs. And we can see other things that get us concerned. If the skin is ever red, if you're seeing actual bald patches, scabbing, the pet being physically affected by the hair loss, meaning scratching and so on and being uncomfortable, those would be things to be able to bring to your veterinarian's attention, because we want to rule out, is there an infectious cause like mites or bacteria or yeast? Is there hormonal problems? Thyroid issues can cause excessive shedding, but it's not just going to be just shedding like we normally see. You're going to see like the trunk is going to lose all the hair, and then the pet's going to have hair on its legs and head. Really weird pattern, but we can see that when the thyroid isn't working right. Cushing's disease, which is an overactive adrenal gland, is another problem. And we can even see genetic problems other than what my bulldogs get. Some of the genetic mutations in color, like the blue Dobermans and blue or violet-colored Labrador retrievers, have a difference in hair coat, and they can have increased alopecia and issues like that. So what do we do about it?
Yeah.
What do we do about it? Number one, buy a good brush and a vacuum.
Yeah.
Brushing is going to not stop shedding, but it's going to trap the hair that is about to fall out. That hair that's in that last stage before it falls out, you're going to get that before it comes out and ends up on your couch or on your furniture. the things that you can see that you can buy over the counter, special like nutraceuticals and supplements and things, really don't do a whole lot. I wish they did. Maybe for pets that have allergies, fatty acid supplements may help with decreasing some of the inflammatory changes and things that may be going on in the skin. But for your normal dog that's on a well-balanced diet, they're not going to do anything. So you don't really have to do any of those supplements. The topical treatments, wouldn't it be nice if there was a magic cure, yeah. Spray this on or whatever. They're basically coat conditioners. They're going to make the skin maybe a little nicer and more supple, and they maybe make the hair a little shinier, but it's not going to stop shedding either. The big thing that we can do for our pets is decrease stress. And so that's why, as a veterinarian, I see a lot of shedding happening when the pet's in the exam room, because all those hairs that are in that I am just about to fall out stage, they fall out in the owner's car, in our waiting room, in our exam room. That's when we can see things. So if your pet is highly stressed, look at ways of decreasing that stress, because that may help decrease some of the shedding as well. Other than that, all I can say is keep brushing and have that little lint roller and get a good vacuum. And when somebody finds a really good pet vacuum, let me know. I've tried every one, and every one of them, nothing works. you get leather furniture and that helps, but still, you know, you've got to still deal with all that hair.
Well, on that note, we have a lot of other types of questions for you today, Dr. Sandy. So I think we'll go right to the phones next. Let's go to Catherine in Random Lake. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I inherited a Berger Picard Shepherd, which is a French herding dog, when my friend Peg passed away. And the dog is hermaphrodite.
Okay.
And I don't know, from what I've read about the breed, it varies in weight from 50 to 70 pounds. And Luke is in the 50-pound range. And he's not put together like a normal male dog. Excuse me. His penis isn't attached to his belly. I say it hangs down like a little monkey penis.
Okay.
And he pees backwards.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
And I'm wondering about what kind of trouble I'm in for in the future with his plumbing.
Yeah.
He's even really a he.
Yeah. Well, a true hermaphrodite is an animal that's born with both ovaries and testicles. Okay. So they have both ovarian tissue and testicular tissue. Probably more common is something called the pseudo-hermaphrodite, which is either born with ovaries or testicles, but has the opposite genitalia. So we'll see a dog with a vulva, but testicles internally, or maybe just under the skin where you could use your imagination, there would be a scrotum there. Male pseudo-hermaphrodites, meaning female external genitalia with male gonads, is more common than the other way around. What we can start running into troubles with when we have these dogs with this type of issue with their intersex conditions is they may be more prone to infections. It's maybe if they've got a remnant of a uterus or something, and they, you know, have still a gonadal tissue there, they can run into troubles with uterine infections. And so sometimes it takes dealing with a surgical specialist to fix these dogs to the point where they can function normally and have, a nice, healthy, long life. And so it's not just your typical, I'm going to spay or neuter the dog. It's going to be doing, usually some reconstructive surgery, and they're all presented differently. So I would strongly recommend that you get your veterinarian to refer you to either a reproduction specialist veterinarian that does small animal reproduction work, or a small animal soft tissue surgeon that has an interest in doing this kind of surgery. I know these pets show up periodically at the vet school, but I know that there are other veterinarians in the area that do this kind of work. And I would look into getting that done because, you know, if the dog starts getting sick, I mean, some of the big problems, other problems we'll see is retained testicles can have a higher rate of cancer, and we can see testicular cancer. And that can be hard to detect because they're inside the body. So it may require ultrasonography to be able to see what parts are there so that a surgical plan can be made. But good for you for taking on a problem dog. These dogs are sometimes hard to adopt.
Thank you very much for calling.
Can I also say real quickly that she did take the dog in. He's 8 years old, and she told me he had both a uterus or ovaries and testicles.
Okay.
That he had both those.
Okay.
And that they've all been removed.
All right.
So that's where he sits right now.
Yeah, and it may just mean can something be done with his external parts to make him more comfortable and avoid things like ascending urinary tract infections, just because openings for urinating may be abnormal, and that would be having that looked into. Perhaps the veterinarian that did the initial surgery was comfortable doing things inside the body, but that specialized kind of plastic surgery outside the body may take a special hand and someone that has more experience in doing that.
Yep. Something else to look into, Catherine. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Gloria and Curtis up next. Hi, Gloria.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you today?
Well, I have a 6-month-old puppy, and about 2 months ago, she decided that she really enjoyed eating her outdoor poop.
Yeah. You know, they make all these products that you can find online, Forbid and Deter, these things that are food additives. And there's even some online suggestions of using things like meat tenderizer and stuff like that on the pet's food. There was a big study that was done looking at dogs that eat their own fecal material or that of other dogs, and they found that using these additives to their stool, which is supposed to make the stool taste bad, helped less than 3% of the dogs. So it doesn't work. So what it comes down to is this is something that's hardwired into dogs. Mother dogs eat their puppies' fecal material when they're nursing their puppies. And so it is a normal behavior during that time of the pet's life. But when it's occurring later, I mean, we always want to make sure they're on a good plane of nutrition, that they don't have any other gastrointestinal issues like a maldigestion, malabsorption problem. If your pet had that, I would be expecting them to be losing weight and having diarrhea and issues. But typically, the great majority of these dogs, there's absolutely nothing wrong with them. It is just a behavior problem. And it comes down to you need to be out there with your dog 100% of the time when they are outside, so that as soon as they defecate, you can redirect them to chasing something else. So have a ball in your pocket, throw the ball, the dog goes to do that, and then you're picking up the fecal material. So it's not there for your dog to be able to get. Yes, it's a big management issue. I can tell you with 3 dogs and the snow melting, I can barely keep up with my backyard. And so with having, if you only have 1 dog, hopefully it'll be a little bit easier for you, but it just comes down to pick it up, and really nothing else works besides that.
Thanks, Gloria. Good luck. Appreciate it. Mabel in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi.
Okay, what I'm calling about is my cats, but I just briefly want to say I bought a Miele vacuum cleaner. I love it. It is so good. And when I was in the shop, I saw that they have one specifically made for pets.
Okay.
I didn't use it, so I don't know anything about it, but I know the regular one is the best vacuum cleaner I've ever seen.
Wonderful. Well, hopefully my house will be cleaner.
Yeah.
Now, the thing about my cats, I have 2. One is obese, so I feed him separate from the other one. He gets his food in the basement. Then I feed the other one. They're both going on 14 years old. They are not litter mates. They're both males, And the other little one, he's part Siamese, but he is the fussiest little eater. I cannot find food he likes. He likes to lick the gravy off of food, and once he licks it, he will not touch it again. I've tried Fancy Feast, giving him the pâté. Now I've gone over to the gravy ones. I bought a whole bunch of new ones. They are called, let's see, it's Tiny Tiger. Not very much success there.
Okay.
What I've been doing now, besides his dry food, I've got some Temptations treats, and I mix them in to trick him, and then he'll eat a little bit of his dry food. I bought some Sheba cuts and gravy. Mm-hmm. No luck there. I got Fancy Feasts that is in a creamy collection. No yep. good there. I cannot find food that this cat will eat.
And, you know, it's really surprising how when you actually look at the calories that many cats that are indoor cats, what they need to be able to maintain their normal weight, it's actually quite low. And so when we look at, oh, you're only eating a little bit, for many cats, that little bit that they're eating, if he's not losing weight, he's active. You've had him checked for medical problems. He doesn't have dental disease. There isn't any reason that would inhibit him from eating. He may be getting enough calories. So then it comes down to, you know, are we creating a feeding disorder by, you know, like eat, eat. You're standing over him and you're making it a stressful experience for him. I mean, I think it's great that you're trying all these different things. Unfortunately, probably your fat cat isn't benefiting from it because there's going to be leftovers left out. And so this is where having a cat that is eating enough to be able to survive on and be comfortable, and then you have another cat that just loves to, you know, lives to eat, you really do have to feed them separately. And, you know, if you look at the box of Temptations, if your cat is eating those, although it is a very expensive type of dry food, I believe it says on the package that it is complete and balanced, meaning that that could be your cat's food. It doesn't, even though it's marketed as treats, if it says it's a complete and balanced product, your cat may be able to eat those. Now, it would be a really expensive way to have your cat eat their food is just eating that particular brand. So, you know, maybe having these other things that you're trying on the side as a way of you know, enhancing what you're giving your cat is really helpful. But you may find that you're going to have electronic feeders or a cat door that allows one cat to get into a room where the food is out all the time, where your Siamese can just nibble and eat when they want to, and your obese cat can, you know, not have access to the food. It's a tough situation to be in, but if your cat is healthy and happy, I would say it's probably getting enough calories and not to worry too much.
My cats love greenies.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if those are complete and balanced. That's the thing. I mean, you have to look at the packaging to be able to see if they are.
Check that.
You'll have to check because you don't want to have treats being the only thing that the cat eats. And
right.
Definitely get that checked out.
Thanks, Mabel. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Lois in Chippewa Falls, we'll get to you in just a second, but just a reminder, we're talking about your pet's health today. Our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer for the Ideas Network. Before we get back to talking about your pet's health, I want to say a big thanks. We had more than 2,100 listeners contribute during our winter member drive. So a big thank you. Your support, of course, makes the independent journalism, the talks like this one, all possible. And if you missed the drive, not too late to join in with a gift at WPR.org. But thanks to everybody who's contributed. And now we will go to, we lost a caller. Dave in Madison? Or no, wait a second. Lois in Chippewa Falls, excuse me.
Hi, my dog chews her toenails, and it doesn't seem to present a problem. She used to love to chew pens, and we had to hide them all the time. So I don't know if she just thinks that's fun. I was just wondering what your idea is.
Well, you know, we do see some medical issues that can cause dogs to have uncomfortable toenails. They can get nail bed infections with yeast. Allergic skin issues may cause them to bite that part of their body as well. There's an immune-mediated problem that is actually, I mean, I see probably half a dozen cases a year that's called lupoid onychodystrophy. It's where the nails become very brittle and will break easily. And so I go right back to the dog and say, let's have a look at those nails and see what's going on. If they're really dry and breaking, or there's like the nail beds are irritated, then we have something that we can deal with, and we start treating for whatever the dog needs to be treated for. Sometimes it's just a matter of the fact that the dog's nails are long and the toes are uncomfortable. Although I don't see dogs with long nails typically biting their nails, it's possible that they would do that. Cats do it all the time. I mean, this is how cats, if they're not going up and scratching on surfaces to remove the husk on their nail, cats' nails grow very differently than dogs' nails. Dogs' nails grow like ours, meaning that they grow in length, and cats grow in depth. And so they go through these cycles of having a crust or a layer on the outside of their nail that comes off, and they may either scratch it off using a scratching post or sometimes with their back feet, bite them off. So go back and have a look at your dog's nails. And if you have any questions, definitely visit with your veterinarian, because foot issues like this could be really uncomfortable for the pet.
There you go, Lois. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Dave in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Dave. Dave, are you there? Well,
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Sorry about that. Hit the wrong button. I've been told that Rottweilers were bred to pull carts. Have you known anybody who's ever, like, trained a Rottweiler, or even two especially, to pull a cart? How hard would that be?
I can't see why not. I have a neighbor that has Newfoundlands that are their cart trained, and it's really fun to see them out in the neighborhood when the weather's nice, pulling their carts, and she actually enters them in competitions and things. So if your dog does not have any hip dysplasia, back issues, or, you know, anything orthopedically that would make it uncomfortable for them, it would be something that would take some training. It's not something that they're going to just be able to, you know, pick up right off the start. But getting involved with some dog training groups that do this, and obviously, if I have a person in Janesville, a couple of the doors down from me, that is doing this, there are local people that work and train dogs and compete in this kind of thing. So it may be a fun activity for your pet. And I have no idea where you would get a cart, what kind of harnesses to use, but definitely get a clean bill of health before you start strapping on extra weights for your dogs.
Yeah, very good.
It's within the realm of reality, you're saying.
Yes. Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And now to Mark in Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Thank you for taking my call. We have a Westie Schnauzer mix. At least that's what we think it is. And about 12 years old, 13 years old. And he has developed like a diarrhea where he's been very well house trained. And now all of a sudden he's going all over when we're not home. And this happened one other time when my daughter, who was the owner, left town and moved to New York. And I don't know if it's stress related, but my wife is pretty tired of it. And I don't know if it's end of life issues or what to think about it. And we've had it to the vet. We've done a lot of things. They've done a lot of investigation already, and they're going to do one more blood test, and then they're saying the next step is like an ultrasound, which is like $1,000 or something.
Yeah. So. There are so many things that can cause dogs to not have normal stool. And when I'm approaching one of these cases, the things that I look at are part of the history are, how long has it been going on? Is this acute or chronic? Is the dog losing weight? what is the, I mean, this is always gross to be talking about at lunchtime, but what is the diarrhea like? Is it small amounts and the dog's got urgency and you may see blood and mucus in it, which puts us in the large bowel type diarrhea? Or is it more small intestine? And do we have an issue with that where the pet may be losing weight and producing larger volumes of softer diarrheic stool and maybe doesn't have that much urgency? It sounds like if your dog is having issues with eliminating in the house, there may be some urgency involved with this. And we always go back to the basics in that we look at, is there, you know, do we have any parasites? So getting not only just a standard fecal, but some specialized tests to look for things like Giardia, which is a very common parasite that affects our dogs. We may look at doing diet changes to either a very low residue diet where it's giving the GI tract a rest, to even going to things like hypoallergenic diets, like a limited antigen diet, a hydrolyzed protein diet. So there's, you know, kind of different dietary approaches. And, you know, but if your dog is showing weight loss, it's been going on for a while, it looks like small bowel diarrhea, then there are some other specialized tests that we jump into. In fact, I just had a kitty in today that we drew a blood sample to recheck and had it sent off to a special gastrointestinal lab in Texas to look at some of the things that can be affecting the small bowel, the cobalamin and folate levels, pancreatic evaluations and things like that. So there are things that we can look at. And then you're right. If everything is failing that way, we're not getting any results, then sometimes we have to start looking at, do we have infiltrative disease or some other organ problems that are causing secondary diarrhea? And that's where, you know, jumping in and doing an ultrasound may be necessary. I mean, I'd question $1,000 for an ultrasound unless your dog needed to have biopsies and anesthesia to have it done. Most ultrasounds are done awake. And but again, I don't know, you know, where you're calling from. I know that in our location, abdominal ultrasounds run probably $450, something in that range. So I'd be questioning that if it was going to be that amount. It's still a lot of money, but again, it's not one of those things that we jump into right away. And so, until you get some answers, definitely confine your dog to make your life easier. And when you're talking about end of life stuff, boy, oh boy, if it's just your pet is just having diarrhea and is living a great quality of life, you know, is that enough to say it's an end of life thing? Personally, I don't think so, but that is something that, you know, you as a family need to sit down and look at if there's other things going on at the same time. Maybe they're urinating in the house, or maybe they can't get up and walk easily, or their appetite's affected, or they have chronic painful conditions that can't be under control. Those would be all things that we would look at, and it's definitely something to be discussing with your veterinarian. I'm sorry I don't have definite answers for you as to how to cure this, but it sounds like your vet is doing everything step by step and going about it correctly.
Good luck, Mark. Thank you very much for calling. And Jan and Toma, we turn to you now. Hi, Jan.
Good morning, and thank you for having Dr. Sandy on today.
Sure.
I have a senior dog. He's a chocolate lab, about 80 pounds. And I would like to start him on CBD oil. I take CBD oil myself with some benefits. It does help me sleep at night, and it eases my arthritis pain. However, my dog is on several medications and vitamins already. And my regular veterinarian is not in favor of CBD oil because she feels that it has not been tested enough yet and that there is no definitive benefits from it. So my question is, what's my best route to go? Do I make an appointment and sit down with another veterinarian?
It would have to be a veterinarian in another state, unfortunately. Our state regulations for veterinarians have, and this was sent via email in December, January, sometime of this year, say that as a veterinarian, we are not able to recommend the use of CBD oil. So your veterinarian basically parroted what the state law is, that we are not supposed to be talking about it, recommending it, advocating it, until laws change. And unfortunately, we're kind of stuck in the middle because anywhere you travel in the state, there are shops now that are opening up selling CBD oil, and some of it is labeled for pets. But I'm not in a position where I am legally able to discuss it with you. So you would have to go to another state, and I had to find a veterinarian that may be able to help you. I can tell you that if you go online, there are lots of research being done. There's lots of research being done at veterinary schools, Colorado, Cornell, I believe Pennsylvania, are doing research. And what I would suggest you do, since I am unable to recommend brands of CBD oil or the use of it, is look at that research, find out what companies are testing, and maybe follow up with seeing if those are available for you rather than going with an untested local product that may not have what you actually want in it.
There you go, Jan. Thanks very much for calling.
I knew that call would come up, and this is a huge issue for veterinarians, is we can't really discuss
it. So it's a political thing?
It's political, and it's the law. I mean, right now, because we do not have the state backing to say we can be talking about it and recommending it, I have to just follow those guidelines.
Yeah.
So,
but if I, as a cat owner, and I...
You wanted to go buy it, by all means.
And they're not going to arrest me.
They're not going to arrest you because you can buy it in the stores. So that's the issue with it, is I'm kind of stuck in the middle. So I can see why she got the response she did from her veterinarian, because that's exactly what the state told us to say.
Well, she mentioned somebody mentioned a chocolate lab, and I'm looking at an email from Dave, and his wife went to Florida for 6 days, and their chocolate lab was very vocal. They put him in a kennel, and when they came back, it appears like he's hoarse.
Yeah.
He can't hit the high notes. It takes to whine, and his bark is not as deep. Can dogs get laryngitis?
They sure can.
Is there something he can do about
it? Well, I used to have a basset hound that, of course, they have the typical, howl and so on. And whenever he would be boarded, he would come back, and it would be just comical because he'd lift his head up to howl and nothing would come out. And it was kind of pleasant to live with them during that time. But if the dog is feeling good, isn't coughing, isn't showing any signs of throat pain, having difficulty swallowing or anything that would say, this is something more, like maybe your dog has kennel cough or, pharyngitis or something that would be uncomfortable for the dog, it's probably just a little bit of vocal cord irritation from hitting those high notes while the dog's been in the boarding kennel. And they often get better in just a matter of a few days and get their voice back. So probably nothing to be concerned about.
Well, Michael and Kakana, what's on your mind?
We have a silver golden doodle. He's about 12 and a half years old. And he was, I don't remember the name of the cancer, but it's an oral cancer. It's supposed to be very aggressive. And he's already lived to the vets. And he seems healthy. He's losing weight. And we're just trying to make him comfortable and happy. And just to mention, we did use a CBD oil. He's just in remission. We're just trying to figure out why we want him to survive, but we're just asking, why would they tell us 65 days and now it's 90 days that he's lived?
Oh, I wish we could, I could come up with, and I'm always grateful. I just had a dog in the other day that lost his life, but it was 8 years after losing his leg to osteosarcoma. And normally we give these dogs months to live, even after leg amputation, because things spread. And so we have our kind of bell curve of dogs live approximately this long, but there's always those outliers that may survive longer. And it's good for you for having a dog that you're able to enjoy comfortable and happy days with. And that's the big thing, is just counting every day like it's a blessing when you have a dog that has something that is terminal. Things that we always want to do is make sure that we're controlling pain, because oral cancers can be very painful. They can affect the dog's ability and cat's ability to be able to prehend food and swallow. And so sometimes we have to adjust what kind of food we use, softer foods or, you know, helping them out with liquid diets and things like that. Sometimes we even put stomach tubes in to be able to allow the dog to kind of bypass that part of their anatomy for eating or the cat's anatomy for eating so that they can be comfortable. And, you know, those are all things that can potentially be done. But how good that, you know, your dog has an aggressive form of oral cancer and is surviving and doing okay. I mean, if you want other opinions, I mean, we have a phenomenal oncology department at the veterinary school that would be able to consult with you and your veterinarian and perhaps offer alternative therapies such as different targeted radiation therapy. We're one of the few places in the country that has tomotherapy. And, you know, that would be something that sometimes for oral cancers do buy them some time and make them more comfortable. And, you know, I'm not sure if anything like that has been explored on the part of your dog. But even using things like appetite stimulants, if your dog isn't eating well, there's a product on the market now called Entice that has been found to be helpful for some pets. And again, that would be something to talk to your oncologist or your veterinarian about if you're not working with a specialist.
Good luck, Michael. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Lynn in Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I have a cat whose eye is getting cloudy, one eye, and I'm assuming glaucoma. And I was wondering, I just noticed a slightly milkiness started about a week ago, and I wanted to wait and make sure it wasn't an infection. But there's nothing wrong. I mean, there's no infection, and her eyelid does not, his eyelid does not, you know, close more on that eye. It doesn't seem to affect him at all. And I was wondering, is there any chance of reversing this with drops, or is it just a foregone conclusion that it'll just totally get blind in that eye?
Well, one, you don't have a diagnosis yet. And glaucoma is an extremely painful thing for an animal to live with. And so I'd be recommending that you go into your veterinarian and have pressures checked, and it's they check pressures just like they do for us. Often we use something called a Tonopen. There's different techniques that are used to be able to see what kind of pressure your pet has, and if the pressures are elevated, there are medications that can be used just like there are in people. But I worry if the cornea is cloudy. Do we have something like a corneal ulcer, some other type of infiltrative corneal disease, or maybe something inside the eye, like a lens that is a cataract, its lens that has dislocated and is sitting up front in the front part of the eye that looks whitish. And so having a very thorough eye exam done will, one, give you a diagnosis, and two, a prognosis, and three, maybe a treatment that is going to keep your cat's vision in that eye. If it's something that cannot be saved and, you know, we deem it painful, many cats can get by with one eye. One of my colleagues has a cat that she just adopted that needed to have its eye removed because it had irreversible ocular disease. And her name is Wink now because she constantly winks at you with one eye. So get that checked out rather than just sitting back and waiting. We don't want your cat to be uncomfortable.
No. And thanks, Lynn. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her with us, and thanks for joining in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Andrea in New London emailed. She has a 4-year-old Beagle lab mix who just started scratching all over. Andrea has a humidifier running, gives her salmon oil with her food, and she's tried fish oil and Benadryl. Nothing seems to work, and the vet says this is normal in the wintertime. Could the cat be allergic, or could she be allergic to Andrea's cats? I think it's the other way around.
Yeah. It does sound, with the dog being itchy, The three big causes of itch in dogs, and you will note that winter is not one of them, is parasitic infections, bacterial or yeast infections, and then allergic type disease. So infectious problems and allergic problems are like right up there in the top. And so we always, when we get a pet in that's itchy, evaluate what are they using for their flea and tick control. Even in the middle of winter, you should be using flea and tick control because pets that have flea allergy dermatitis, it just takes one flea bite and they can be living in your home. And so, you know, making sure that you're on something. I like the oral flea and tick products because they also get some of the other mites that can cause the dog to itch, like scabies and Demodex. Making sure that there isn't an underlying yeast or bacterial infection by doing some cytology and assessing whether there's an infection there that needs to be treated as well. If we have ruled out all those things, then we start looking at, is does this dog have allergies? And like I said earlier in the show, we were talking about shedding. The supplements that we use are not usually that effective. They may help improve skin quality to a degree, but they're not going to make the dog super comfortable. And so we may have to be looking at other prescription drugs that may be helpful. We, you know, we find that Benadryl for treating allergies or any of the other antihistamines really are not effective in dogs. They have so many other allergy mediators besides histamine that cause itching that Benadryl, basically it may take the edge off the dog by making them a little dopey. So I don't jump to using that right away. Usually try to make the dog more comfortable by using one of the prescription products if we've ruled out all those other things that can cause itch. So time to go back to your veterinarian and say, let's look at the skin again, because definitely it isn't winter.
Steven emailed that at a recent checkup for his cat, the veterinarian advised him to provide her with only grain-free food. He also spoke of the benefits of a raw diet. Could you comment on what's the ideal diet for cats?
Oh, that's a tough one because we've got all this information now for dogs saying don't feed grain-free diets because of the risk of cardiomyopathy. Cats, on the other hand, are carnivores, and so they can get by on grain-free diets. And so I think that if you want to feed your cat a grain-free diet, but knowing that even diets with grains where the grains are cooked, if the cat is healthy and normal weight and doesn't have any underlying issues, like it's not a diabetic or it doesn't have obesity problems, then those carbohydrates are probably not going to cause the cat that much problem. Raw diets, on the other hand, the big issue with that, any of them, whether it be one that you purchase that's already pre-made for you or one that you make yourself, is the fact that they're usually unbalanced. Very few of them have been shown to be complete and balanced and meet your cat's everyday needs. And then there's the risk of infectious diseases, E. coli, Salmonella, Listeria, all those things that are pretty scary for people. And because we're dealing with the cat, we're dealing with the cat litter box, we're dealing with their dishes and food bowls, those are all things that are going to be a source of contamination for people. So I always encourage people that want to try a raw diet to go to the CDC's website and look up raw diets for pets and just evaluate their stand on the safety for the humans that actually live with the pets. So besides the health factors for the pet itself, we have the issue of the health factors for people. And it just makes me worried to be able to have something like that, especially if there's anyone in the household, like young children or anybody that is immunocompromised.
Yeah, for sure. Craig and Mellon has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Craig.
Hi. Mine is skin related too. I have a 10-year-old beagle, and I've had him since he was 5, and he's always had problems. He gets yeast infections in his skin. You know, you can actually pull the hair apart and see the yellow gunk coming out.
Wow.
And right now, I just gave it, and I got prescribed him the anti-itch medication, and I have like a shampoo that I have to bathe them like once a week just to keep them from scratching.
But, okay. What is the anti-itch medication you're using? Do you know what it is? Okay. That's okay. It's just, you know, when we're dealing with chronic yeast problems, the things that I always I like to think about is that yeasts are an opportunistic infection. The only place where you should find yeast in real low numbers is in the dog's ears. We find them there with them being asymptomatic. When they show up other places on the body, it's usually because the skin is moist, such as in skin folds if the pet is overweight and we've now got skin-on-skin contact, or we have something that's changing the chemistry of the skin, like a dog that has allergies, then we get a little more concerned that that inflammation is making the skin warmer and moister and allowing yeast to overgrow. So we always want to address what's the underlying problem. You know, can we find it, whether it be allergies, a hormonal issue, obesity, or just a breed-related issue, such as, like, I have bulldogs and they have all the skin folds that rub on each other and they get secondary yeast infections. And then we are looking at probably doing more than once a week bathing. I like to have something applied to the skin that's antifungal on a daily basis. And whether that be in a spray or a mousse form, with bathing at least a couple of times a week. So on the days that you can't bathe, you treat with something topical to be able to make your dog feel more comfortable. We will even go with oral antifungal agents that are prescription medications to be able to knock the yeast down if it's a really severe yeast problem as well. So I'm not sure what the anti-itch pill was. If it's a steroid, I would avoid using that. That's just going to suppress the dog's immune system. Yes, it may mask the itching, but it's not going to solve your dog's problem. Really look into what else can we use on those non-bathing days that may be helpful to make your dog feel more comfortable.
Good luck, Craig. Thank you very much for calling. Kelly in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I had a question regarding, I have a smaller breed. She's a Chihuahua Rat Terrier mix, about 11, 12 pounds. But she won't, from 3 months old, she won't wear a harness. I couldn't figure out why she would not walk with me. She was so stubborn. And then one day I didn't put her harness on. I just attached her leash to her collar and she walked fine. And then when it became cold, and she's older now, but I just finally was like, I'm going to call an ass, because I've tried, introducing the coat earlier in the year, but she won't wear a coat at all. And she's small, she's short haired. I was just wondering, I mean, we only go for short walks in the winter.
Yeah. My dogs are exactly the same way. I put anything on them and they act like they just won't move. They just stand there and freeze like, oh my goodness, I can't walk. So it is something that is a unique thing for dogs. They have to adjust to it very early in life. And so having a dog when they're puppies, you know, getting comfortable with wearing clothes will make it easier when they're older. I don't know what to tell you, because I would love to be able to take my dogs on friends' boats, but because they're bulldogs and can't swim, I want to put a life jacket on them. I bought a life jacket, and they will not move. I cannot get these 50-pound dogs out the front door because they will not walk with the life jacket on. They just act like I'm doing something horrible to them. So I wish I had advice for you, but I really don't. So, you can try desensitizing, like maybe just putting something on your dog's back and giving her treats and making her feel like, oh, this isn't so bad. And gradually working up to having something encased around her body and making it a fun experience for her. Whether it's going to work or not, I don't know. But, just be wise about being out in the really cold weather.
There you go, Kelly. Thank you. Jane in Suring, your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I've got about a 20-pound miniature pincher. She's 14 years old. She was put on vinazapril before the vet arrived at the correct diagnosis, which was a fungal infection. She's been treated for the fungal infection, and as far as we know, it's gone. But they've kept her on the vinazapril just 'cause. So for the last couple of years, she's been taking it. And recently I noticed that on the days that for some reason or other she didn't get it like she should have, she seems better. And what I'm wondering is, what are the long-term side effects of this if it turns out that it's actually not necessary of keeping her on this?
Well, the probably the two big reasons that we use that class of drug, benazepril or enalapril, is for dogs that are hypertensive, if they've got a hypertension problem. So I don't know if your dog had an issue where their blood pressure was elevated. If so, that would be monitored. The other thing would be if they have an issue with what's called proteinuria, meaning they're passing protein in their urine. That is abnormal unless the dog has a urinary tract infection or something, then we would expect to see protein. But if they don't have an infection and their kidneys are sick to the point where they are passing protein, that is one of the drugs that we will use, is either a benazepril or enalapril. So I would be going back and say, ask your veterinarian, why was it prescribed to begin with? And if it was prescribed for either of those things, hypertension or proteinuria, it does require monitoring. I mean, we get the dog in and usually periodically be checking protein level in the urine or blood pressure or both, and, you know, adjust dosages, add in other drugs as necessary. It's not typically something that we use. It's not something that we use for treating fungal infections. So it had to be something else that your dog was being treated for that maybe just wasn't expressed to you at one of the former vet at the one of your other visits. So talk to your veterinarian and find out why, because, you know, that drug can have side effects. And sometimes we can see some weird side effects that if your dog doesn't need it, or maybe you can switch to a different class of drug for treating the same problem and your dog does better, then that would be, you know, better for your dog as well.
Yeah, makes sense. Jane, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor, at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm losing my voice here. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with Dr. Sandy. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at your pet's health on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Callers online, we can take some calls. We've got some emails, so lots going on here. And I think we might just as well, Sandy, go right to the phones to Mike in La Crosse next. Hi, Mike. Thanks for waiting.
Hello. Yes, I'm calling. We've got a Cocker Spaniel, possibly a Cocker Spaniel Poodle cross mix in the family that has very smelly ears, like stinky feet. And I was wondering what could cause that and what would be the treatments.
Cocker Spaniels as a breed, you know, they have those really droopy ears. And especially if you turn them into a cockapoo, like a mix, they may have hair and droopy ears. And Cocker Spaniels are very good at making sebum, and kind of they tend to have a greasier ear canal to begin with. And so I always worry about secondary infections. And so that's always the first thing. When there's an odor, what's causing it? And so getting some swabs and actually having a look under the microscope to see, do we have an overgrowth of bacteria, or do we have a yeast problem? And sometimes basing treatment off of what we find, we can then get the odor under control. Once we have any infections under control, it may be a matter of finding a correct cleaner that would work well for your dog that you can use maybe on a weekly basis to just kind of cut the oils and keep things under control that way. One of the basic hygiene things that we do for these dogs with real droopy ears is making sure if the hair is growing around the head, around the ear canal, is to keep that trim short. And it may mean that you have to do a little bit of grooming between your normal grooming, where you would be going to the grooming parlor, doing it yourself. Again, just to help with increasing the air circulation in the ear canal, that sometimes really helps with keeping odor to a minimum.
There you go. Good luck, Mike. Thank you so much for calling. And Deborah in Winona, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I have a 17-year-old cat who has irritable bowel disease, which he's on prednisolone for, and he also has severe arthritis, which is getting worse. And I'm wondering about pain medication and quality of life. Right now, he takes 100 milligrams of gabapentin 3 times a day. And the vet doesn't want to put him on an anti-inflammatory because of the prednisolone. So do you have any ideas about other pain medication?
Well, I'm surprised that your cat's even walking around on that level of gabapentin. Gabapentin is a drug that is primarily used for neuropathic pain, but we do use it commonly in cats for dealing with just kind of generalized pain conditions. But we use it at that kind of level to be able to handle kitties that are scared in the clinic if they become really frightened and become fractious because they're scared. Giving them 100 milligrams of gabapentin usually knocks their socks off, and we can get them in, and they're usually just will sit there and let us do everything we need to have done to them. So that's why I'm like, what? That's an awful lot, unless your cat is like massively huge. Other things that you may want to look into for treating arthritis would be there's an injectable joint supplement that we use that's called Adequin. It's labeled for dog use, but we do use it off-label for cats, and we teach owners how to do that as an injectable. And it's called a PGAG, polysulfated glycosaminoglycan, and it's used in horses and dogs. And I'd suggest that you do a little bit of reading on that if you feel that you could potentially give injections. I've had some really good success with owners finding that their cats feel a lot better when they're on that particular medication. The other pain medication that you may want to be looking into, and it can be a little pricey, but it would be compatible with the other drugs that you're on, is one that's called buprenorphine. It is a controlled substance, so you'd have to get it from your veterinarian or from a formulating pharmacy with a prescription from your veterinarian, but that may be helpful as well. I have never had a cat on buprenorphine and that high a level of gabapentin to know if it's going to make them even more groggy. But that would be one of the side effects from being on that medication. And, you know, when you're talking about quality of life, there are lots of different quality of life scales out there that are helpful for owners to be able to sit down and have a look at. One of the websites that I would suggest that you may want to look into, it's, and I know it sounds kind of funny going to a home euthanasia site, but there's a couple actually on the market locally. We have in the Madison area a group that's called Journeys Home, and they have a quality of life scale on there that you can go to have a look at to sit down and maybe on a weekly basis assess or a monthly basis how your cat is doing. And it takes that very subjective looking at what your cat's doing and turns it into something very objective. You're actually putting a number to your cat's quality of life. The other source is Lap of Love, which is a national group that does home euthanasias for pets and palliative care and so on, kind of hospice care for pets. And they have a great quality of life scale information on there as well. So those would be two places for you to go. So don't give up, but boy, oh boy, I'd want to double check that dose of medication. So, yeah.
There you go, Deborah. Thank you very much for calling. Gwen emailed that her dog, a Bernese mix, has several small sores on its feet. They're not healing. First appeared in December. They haven't grown in size. He's been treating with cefalexin. Then after further tests was switched to amoxicillin. They clean it twice daily with Malaceb and have been told to keep them dry hard this time of year, of course. So he wears waterproof boots when walking and they keep him from licking when he's in the house. But the sores aren't going away. He's getting over blasto, which was diagnosed last summer.
Ooh, okay.
Gwen's worried about the lack of healing and wonder if there's anything else they should be doing.
Yeah, you know, when I hear blasto and non-healing skin wounds, I worry, is this the blastomycosis, which is a fungal infection coming back, which can sometimes present as non-healing wounds on the skin. I would hope that the owner and her veterinarian are doing further blasto evaluations. And one of the tests that we do is called a blasto urine antigen test. You'd have to take a urine sample in to your veterinarian. It gets sent to an outside lab just to see where you're at with dealing with whether this is an active blasto infection. You also may want to be looking into, since you've treating it for infection and you're keeping it clean and you're doing all those things, sometimes we have to get a diagnosis via biopsy. And although feet are not a nice thing to biopsy, you could take a little couple of millimeter biopsy and have a look to see what may be going on there. I'm a little stumped, but I worry about whether this is an issue with blasto coming back. It can be a difficult infection to get treat and get under control in a short period of time.
Jean in Viola, it's your turn. Hi, Jean.
Well, good afternoon, Larry. I've got two Maltese poodles. They're 3 years old, and I was wondering about grooming them. I've been getting them groomed about every 2 months. And this winter, I got them groomed the first week in December, and I let them go for 3 months because of the cold weather. Now, did I do it right? I'm getting them groomed again tomorrow.
Yeah, if you're keeping up with the hair coat between grooming, so you're keeping up with brushing and, keep making sure that they don't have any matting, that's fine. You can let them get a little bit longer as long as the areas, important areas like around their rear end, the hair around their ears, their eyes and so on aren't getting long enough that it's starting to cause problems. By all means, let them get a little hairier if necessary. Sometimes it comes down to personal taste and whether you like your dogs having that extra hair. But if you can't keep up with the brushing or selective trimming that may need to be done between groomings, then it's time to get back into that every 2 month schedule to keep everybody looking good and more comfortable.
There you go,
it's
Jean.
Definitely personal choice, really. Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling. John from Ashland emailed about his 2-year-old long-haired husky. Got her spayed six months old or so, and noticed a few months ago that she leaks urine while sleeping, and while awake she'll start licking to clean it up. Took her to the vet, tested for infection, came back clear. They did say it's uncommon for leaking to occur in spayed dogs.
I think he said it's common.
Oh, I'm sorry, common.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So what we've basically done is put this dog into menopause. We've removed the ovaries, and so we've lost that hormonal priming of the bladder sphincter. And so it is a common problem in spayed female dogs to have this incontinence issue, especially if they're carrying any extra weight or they tank up on water before going to bed and they get into a really relaxed state and their bladder fills up and then a little bit of urine will dribble out. This isn't something that you necessarily have to deal with. There are medications that can be used to be able to make your dog more comfortable and to keep your house cleaner as well, because it's usually like their dog beds and things that end up getting soiled, which means more laundry and cleaning for you to do. Of the classes of drugs that we use, there's one that's called phenylpropanolamine or PPA, that for young dogs, very safe drug to consider using. The downside is you have to use it a couple times a day, sometimes up to 3 times a day, but it tightens up the bladder sphincter. And then there's other hormonal type drugs that we use. There's estriol type product that is one that's used daily. Then there's even some estrogen type drugs that are not licensed for use in dogs that after you have to go through a formulating pharmacy to get, that's diethyl stilbestrol, and they all have their pros and cons with different side effects, and that would be something to talk to your veterinarian about. But you don't necessarily have to live with this. I think it's your vet's done the right thing. Rule out infection, rule out causes for making more urine, such as diabetes or kidney disease or anything like that. And if everything's come back normal, then selecting one of these drugs is going to make everybody's life a lot more comfortable.
Okay. There we go. Jack in Germantown, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 13-year-old golden retriever who last fall came down with symptoms that appeared to be a cold. And this cold lasted longer than we thought it should. My dog was blowing his nose sometimes with great force. Then I became suspicious that maybe there was a foreign object up there. I took him to the vet, and they put him on some medications, antibiotics, and we gave it a little bit of time, and it didn't go away. He's had discharge in one nostril, or at least it started out that way. We ultimately wound up taking him to more of a specialist and had a rhinoscopy done. They tested for, they cultured for fungus. They checked for Aspergillus. They biopsied for any cancer, and everything came back negative. And so this continued on. They put him on carprofil for, I think, an anti-inflammatory and a little pain.
Mm-hmm.
Then that nothing was helping. So then I took the next step and had a CAT scan done.
Good.
And that all came back clear. And I did my own research on it and just looking up things on the internet. And the information I found was there could still be fungal up there. However, it could be up higher. They couldn't have gotten to a spot where they could test for it.
Mm-hmm.
But if they do the procedure, which involves putting the dog under, 30% of the time they have to repeat it. And then in 50% of the time, if I got all this right, they ultimately really don't find out what's wrong. And so they put the dog on prednisone, which took its toll on him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he really had a lot of muscle mass loss. And so we ultimately took him off the prednisone. We backed him off as we're supposed to. It was under, you know, all the guidance of the vet, backed him off the prednisone. And now he's back on carprofil. And they tried a different antibiotic. And it seems to improve. Occasionally it's out of both nostrils, but primarily out of one. And so now he's just sort of, you know, living with this horrible running nose occasionally.
Yeah.
And he has good days and bad days.
Yeah.
But I'm 13 years old.
You're jumping through all the appropriate hoops for your dog. And I affectionately call what you went through with your dog the nasal extravaganza. Normally, kind of the order that we would do things would be evaluate the dog. Being a 13-year-old dog with unilateral nasal discharge, I put tumor or a foreign body up higher on the list. We just don't see colds or like chronic infections like we would normally get. And so that's why they're looking down the path of weird fungal infections and, you know, problems that way. I typically don't see these cases because they are so involved. I send them to one of our internists and they usually do a CT scan, then rhinoscopy, biopsies, nasal flushes, titers. You know, they go through all these things to that kind of a stepwise fashion to be able to get some answers. Usually with all that, we find an answer. And so I'm a little stumped as to what may be going on with your dog. It should be, if it was an infection, it should be getting better. My guess is that there's probably either a foreign body in there that they didn't find. So if they didn't do any nasal flushing, something could still be stuck in there. And so that would be something to go back and talk to the veterinarian that did all this nasal work and say, did you just look up there or did you actually flush the nasal passage and collect the material to be able to have a look to see what's going on? And I have to assume, too, that the person that was reading the CT scan was a radiologist that are able to look at those because they can be tough to interpret. And they are also evaluating things like the teeth, which sometimes we can have an abscess tooth that is draining into the nasal passage that can be causing symptoms as well. So I think it's time to, you know, gather up all your information and just say, we got to go back to the drawing board and see what did we miss on this? Is there something else that we could be doing? Because this is not normal. And I really don't know what else to tell you because you've jumped through all the hoops. But the one thing I didn't hear is the flushing, diagnostic flushing, to see if that would help your dog.
Good luck, Jack. Thank you very much for calling. That's a tough one. Barbara in Grand Marsh. Hi.
Hi. This is a question about whether I'm doing the right thing or not. I had a Leon burger that I had spayed, and the elderly vet said he knew all about their not having to have a certain kind of anesthetic. Well, he didn't, and he killed her. So that has stuck in my brain, and now my grandson has a year-old corgi male, and the vet is talking about neutering him. And I think the influence that I have is that it's frightening to me.
And it's frightening because of your experience with an anesthetic adverse reaction.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Plus, this dog has gone nowhere except in the home and in the beautiful yard with my grandson is in his 20s. But then they said that the dog would have to stay overnight, and that's a worrisome thing. So am I being nasty by doing this to them?
You know, I think, you know, you have obviously a reason for being a little afraid, and a lot afraid. Anesthesia, and I don't know when the anesthesia was done, what kind of monitoring was done, you know, the overall health that your dog may have been in. Did they have any other underlying diseases that weren't picked up? So what I typically look at for when we're doing elective surgeries like this, if the dog is normal on physical exam, has normal pre-anesthetic lab work done, and that varies depending on the age of the dog, but making sure that they're not anemic and that their kidneys are working fine and preferably liver issues are ruled out, then and you've got every bell and whistle on them. They're on fluids, they're monitoring their blood pressure, monitoring their temperature, anesthetic monitoring, everything is looked at. If that is all being done and they're being monitored postoperatively, and there's someone in the hospital to monitor them that evening to make sure that they're not left alone. And this is a problem, is there someone actually there observing the dog? And in some practices, there are veterinary technicians there at night and veterinarians on call. Those would be all things that I would be asking about to help alleviate your fears about having this done. It is a relatively simple procedure. The main reason, the two reasons why we do it are, one, to sterilize the dog so he's not indiscriminately breeding, but also to help some behavior issues that we see in dogs, leg lifting, fighting with other boy dogs, roaming to, look for love down the road, and then prostate disease and testicular cancer down the road for the dog. So looking at all of those things would be things that we need to be, weighing out for the dog's health. And so I probably, if your son is working with a veterinarian that he trusts, or your son's working with a veterinarian that he trusts, I'd say, put your fears aside, that this should go very smoothly. Although there are rare cases of anesthetic complications, they are very, very rare. And we do everything we can to be able to eliminate those.
Barbara, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Sandy, we've got just a short time left here. There were some concern about that COVID-19 virus. Is it something the pets can get?
No. At this point, we are not concerned about pets getting it or transmitting it, although the national guidelines are that if you have the disease, or these are the international guidelines,
right,
the World Veterinary Association, to probably avoid contact with everybody, including your pets, that does not mean that you need to abandon your pets. We want to make sure that they are getting the care they need. Now, some people will go online and say, well, I know that dogs can get coronavirus. Well, the canine coronavirus is very different than this human pneumonia coronavirus that people get. In dogs, it causes mild diarrhea. It's self-limiting. And in cats, we have a coronavirus as well that can, in rare cases, well, not that rare, but they can become a very significant disease called FIP in cats. Again, it's just one of those things where coronaviruses are prevalent not only in the human world, but also in the animal world, and not to be mixing the two up and thinking that they're going to transmit from one species to the other.
And on that note, we'll look forward to your next visit.
I'll
Thanks,
see you
Sandy.
Next month.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her with us. Thank you so much for joining us, and please do stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.